writer's voice. To celebrate our 30 years of on-air service, Virginia Voice's Patty Campbell talks to noted writers about their lives and work.
I'm your host for these programs, Patty Campbell, and today I welcome Times-Dispatch columnist Michael Paul Williams. Welcome, Michael Paul.
Thanks. How are you doing, Patty?
I'm good, and I'm really glad to have you here today to read some of your columns for us. But before we start reading, I want to talk to you a little bit about the column. Your column has attitude, no question about that. Talk to me a little bit about what you try to do with the column.
Well, what I want to do with the column mostly is make people think about things, perhaps introduce them to a point of view that they hadn't considered. If they agree with it, fine. If they don't, well, if they've had to kind of tumble over it a bit and reach the same conclusion, well, I think it's good for people to test their viewpoints against opposing viewpoints. But most of them trying to start a conversation.
And does that conversation actually take place with you very often? Do people get in touch with you and respond to your columns?
Oh, yes. It's a successful day when I come in to the newsroom and fire up the computer and there are all sorts of emails. Taking issue with what I've written, agreeing with what I've written, if there's this kind of chorus online, pro and con, at the tail end of the column in the reader comment section. If there's a reaction, that's a success, whether they agree or not. If there's if there are crickets chirping, not so good.
Columns are really a sign of a fair amount of success as a newspaper man. How did the column come about, and what was your background before you started the column?
I had been at the Times-Dispatch 10 years. I started out in our Williamsburg bureau as a correspondent covering Eastern Virginia.
Were you from Williamsburg? Are you a Virginia?
No, I'm a Richmond native.
Oh, okay.
Born and raised here.
Where'd you go to high school?
Went to Hermitage High School.
Me too.
Oh.
Okay, go ahead. Right. You were in Williamsburg.
So did Williamsburg, came to the main newsroom, covered Chesterfield County, and covered Richmond City Hall. And around that time, 1991, the Richmond News Leader, which some folks may remember as our evening newspaper, announced that it was shutting down. And we were told to basically give management three jobs that we would like to do as part of a reorganization that would involve the merging of the former newsleader staff with the Times-Dispatch staff. And I saw this as an opportunity. And I went to my editor at the time and I said, basically the paper needs a different sort of voice in its commentary. To that point, the Times-Dispatch, like most newspapers in Virginia and probably nationwide at that time, did not have a black columnist. And I felt like in a city with Richmond's demographics and with our readers' demographics that this was an omission.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an argument that they bought, and that's how I started writing the column.
Does it take a fairly thick skin or a lot of guts to bring a different voice to the newspaper?
Well, I think it takes a thick skin to be a reporter under any circumstances. So, yeah, I mean, throwing your opinions out there will tend to bring some heat on you. But I toss some heat out there, hopefully, on a good day. So who am I to flinch when it comes back at me?
Do you ever feel like you have to share more of yourself than you'd really like to share?
Well, my columns typically over the years haven't been terribly self-revelatory. There have been those occasions, and I'll read one of them, but mainly I'm writing off the news, and that's certainly the direction that the newspaper wants from me now, go off the news. But I've never been one to really reveal a tremendous lot about myself and my columns because I'm not sure people would be interested.
Oh, yeah. But I think if we read, we do get an idea of what your opinions are on news factors.
Yeah. So hopefully, by reading my columns and reading what I choose to riff off news-wise and the opinions I formulate, you get a sense of my value system and what I hold dear and what matters to me and occasionally what I do in the way of hobbies. and just what I, just who I am.
Okay. Well, read us a column.
Okay. The first column I'm going to read is among the first columns that I wrote after getting the job as a columnist. It's dated June 22nd, 1992. It's, if memory serves, the third column that I wrote after getting the job. And it was an homage to my father, who died in March of 1992, several months before I began column writing. So he never got to read a column of mine, which obviously is a tremendous regret, but just in the larger piece of just really missing my father. It was a Father's Day. It was time to Father's Day. And the headline was "A Role Model for Celebration of Life, Manhood." Dad had his own way of celebrating Father's Day. We'd suggest eating out or a treat. He'd respond with a predictable lack of enthusiasm. "We can eat better at home," he'd protest. Dad had a wonderful way with barbecued ribs, sweet potato casserole, and his soul pot of chitlins and pig feet. Dad knew food and was not easily impressed by restaurants. But he'd go along with our Father's Day program. I surmised later it was for his amusement. Of course, the restaurant food would be tepid and bland, the service comatose, the check indigestion-inducing. Dad would reach into his wallet, pull out his credit card, and pick up the tab. He'd try to restrain himself, but an "I told you so" would always escape. I always suspect that this moment was the peak of his day. This Father's Day was different. Dad died on March 19th after a nine-month battle with lung cancer. He left a huge void in my life, one that could have easily metastasized into bitterness. But I've come to realize that for 33 years, I was blessed with something missing in an increasing number of African-American households: an everyday father who was a positive role model. I couldn't celebrate Father's Day this year, so I'm celebrating my father's life. Happy Father's Day, Dad. This one's for you. Our culture has tended to celebrate as matriarchs. Somewhere along the way, African-American fathers begin to take a pounding. Many people fear that black male heads of household are an endangered species. Absentee fathers, alcoholic fathers, abusive fathers, deadbeat fathers. Obviously, the rap sheet against the black male often isn't a bum rap. The depressing numbers speak for themselves. Nationally, more than half of black families with children under 18 are held together by women. As Governor L. Douglas Wilder said, "Making babies is no act of manhood. Rather, the passage into manhood begins with making mature decisions and lifelong commitments, and forming structured, loving families." Dad lived commitment. He spent 36 years at Virginia Union University, where he was the director of food service, but he wouldn't leave for work each morning until he'd fed his two sons breakfast. Each evening, usually as Walter Cronkite told us the way it was, Dad would return. He'd greet us warmly, jingling his keys and whistling like a thrush. Clearly, he was delighted to be home. He married Mom, a Korean War widow, in 1957. In the bargain, he inherited a 4-year-old son from Mom's first marriage. Dad's distribution of love and parental guidance to my brother and me was so even-handed through the years that biological distinctions blurred into irrelevancy. When Pooh played football for Benedictine High, Dad and I would attend the games each Friday night. As my brother dashed down the sidelines toward another touchdown, no one was prouder than Dad. "That's my boy," he'd yell, arms upraised in triumph. Pooh and I grew up and left home, but would generally find our way back around mealtime on Sunday evenings. Even if Dad hadn't prepared the meal, he was at his best playing the convivial host, carving the meat, badgering guests in the second helpings, handing me an ice-cold beer as we watched the game. Dad wasn't one to impart lessons in a heavy-handed fashion. He wasn't a lecturer. Didn't have to be. The examples he set, his love and respect for mom, his devotion to his job, his Gibraltar-like faith in the face of illness, were so vivid that a script wasn't necessary. In his easygoing, effortless manner, Dad shaped me in his own image. He taught me how to be a man. I don't have any children yet, but that shouldn't stop me from imparting some of the wealth Dad bestowed. It's time to give back. I plan to take a more active role in the shaping of some youngster's life, perhaps as a big brother. I personally know many African-American males who are successful, are gainfully employed, and have never seen the inside of a jail cell. They can serve as fine examples for a youngster in need of their time, wisdom, and love. Fractured black families are nothing new, but we have a proud history of extending beyond the boundaries of our bloodlines, of looking out for each other. It's another part of our heritage we do well to rediscover. Let's make Father's Day a celebration of black manhood fulfilled.
Wow, that was beautiful.
Thank you.
Very beautiful. You wrote that in 1992. Do you have children yet?
No, I wasn't married at the time, and I've since married, but we do not have children.
Okay.
We have lots of nieces and nephews and godchildren, but no children.
Do you try in your relationship with your nieces and nephews to emulate your father? I mean, how has he impacted your life, Michael Paul?
It's not. I'm my father's child. I don't know if any attempt at emulation is necessary. I have many of his mannerisms. My mom says increasingly that I look like him, although I feel like I always did. So I don't think it really takes any effort.
Oh, thank you very much for sharing that with us. Really, really beautiful.
Thank you, Patty.
What's next?
Since I mentioned then-Governor Wilder in the previous column, we'll transition to Mayor Wilder.
Okay.
Some 13 years later, it looks like. This one I wrote during his term as mayor, after probably the turning point of his time as mayor, his eviction of the school board from City Hall.
Okay.
Which was a singular event, as anyone who can recall. Headline, aptly, Wilder goes over the top. And all along, you thought you'd elected a mayor. As it turns out, you've installed a dictator. The trappings of tyranny were on display Friday night as Mayor L. Douglas Wilder imposed martial law on City Hall when attempting to evict the Richmond School Administration from the building. A moving crew was reinforced by city police officers, who barred the public and media from the building, even as an emergency school board meeting took place inside. Wilder, in his evolution from Democrat to autocrat, seemed to be channeling Emperor Palpatine of Star Wars. City cops, who have more important work to do, were employed as moving van stormtroopers. Police Chief Rodney Monroe and Assistant Police Chief Ray Tarasovic, who literally blocked the City Hall doorway, were reduced to Darth Vader figures. All that was missing was a John Williams soundtrack blaring the Imperial March. Earlier in the day, in a sleazy bit of business that would have done J. Edgar Hoover proud, Wilder's office announced that an investigation had linked the computer in the office of City Council President William J. Pantley to online porn sites. Pantley, oddly the only person named as a result of the probe, had led the council in blocking the school system eviction. He denied any improper use of the computers and said the city never informed him of the matter. Whatever porn that might have been found on the computers could not have been as obscene as what transpired Friday when the mayor acted as if he were above the law. Critics feared that a strong mayor form of government would lead to a police force of political pawns, but few imagined that police would be utilized to enforce an office-based coup d'etat. What's next for Generalissimo Wilder? Perhaps the former talk show host will take over the local airwaves. Or rather than keeping reporters out of City Hall, he'll simply shut down the newspapers. Heck, why not suspend elections altogether? Then the national media might stop calling Richmond the former capital of the Confederacy and start referring to us as a tobacco republic. Look, no one is saying the school administration, the school board, and the city council are blameless in this sorry state of affairs. But Wilder, who has an almost pathological need to bully, has consistently eschewed collaboration in favor of over-the-top confrontation. It's a mystifying approach to governance, given the considerable charms at his disposal. It's also a strange tactic for a mayor purportedly concerned about saving taxpayers' money. His feud with the school system has cost hundreds of thousands of dollars in legal and consulting fees, not to mention an estimated $250,000 to $450,000 thrown away as a result of Friday's abortive eviction. The mayor has insisted on treating 900 East Broad Street as part of his real estate portfolio, not unlike his riverfront home in Charles City County. But City Hall is the people's building, owned by Richmond taxpayers. Police should not be used to shield the public and media from public business. Friday night's chaos should strip the bark off an administration that has expended too much energy marshaling authority and too little advancing a coherent agenda. Or as George Orwell wrote, power is not a means, it is an end.
Fighting words, Mr. Michael Paul Williams. When you write something as strong as that and as terrific as that, I might add, do you ever have to kind of talk your editors through getting it in, or does it go in?
Well, there was no problem with talking my editors into going in, into putting this into the paper, because it strikes at the heart of what we do as reporters and as the media, and that's serve as public watchdog. When we're shut out, that's when we need to be most indignant. So this didn't require any salesmanship at all.
Great, great. I can't wait to hear the next one.
Okay, from one historic political figure to another, L. Douglas Wilder, of course, being the first African-American elected governor, to Barack Obama, the first African-American president elected in the United States. This one was written on election night, literally on the fly, on deadline, which was very exciting and a lot of fun, as the returns came in. Headline, Obama win opens doors for all in U.S. Wesley Carter, 101, can't recall his first presidential ballot, but will never forget the vote he cast yesterday. He arrived at Hermitage Methodist Home at 5:45 a.m. to vote for Senator Barack Obama. A century's worth of experience teaches one not only to arrive early, but also to temper expectations. But 15 hours later, the retired Armstrong High School math teacher dared to voice the obvious as he watched the electoral votes pile up in the Obama column. I've been thinking that Martin Luther King's dream might be coming true, or one of his dreams, he said as he sat in the den of his Sherwood Park home. And I think God may have something to do with this thing, too. He watched an interview with a Birmingham, Alabama minister, which was juxtaposed with decades-old images of civil rights protesters being blasted with fire hoses and attacked by police dogs. We've come a long way from that, haven't we? Said Carter, who shared his own memories of life in segregated Richmond. He didn't think it would happen in his lifetime. Neither did I. Neither did I. But as I'm writing this, Obama's being declared the winner. To celebrate Obama as the first black president is to oversimplify his place in history. Obama has emerged at a time when America can no longer be captured in a black and white snapshot. He is a biracial, multi-ethnic citizen of the world, a product of Hawaii, Kansas, Kenya, Indonesia, the halls of the Ivy League, and the streets of Chicago. Obama is the first president to truly embody our nation's rich tapestry, none of which diminishes the fact that he's the most implausible president-elect in our nation's 232-year history. The long-time lie has become the truth. In America, any child can grow up to be president. No one knows for sure whether Obama will be a great president, but already he has joined the exclusive ranks of truly transformational figures, a list that includes Abraham Lincoln, John F. Kennedy, and Martin Luther King, Jr. Lincoln preserved the Union. Kennedy's youthful idealism shaped modern America. King forced America to live up to his ideals. Obama represents Lincoln as unifier, Kennedy as idealist, and King as visionary. King, however, would find little joy in an Obama presidency that does not elevate the lives of America's poor. In that regard, Obama is not only uniquely equipped to speak candidly on issues of race, but to serve as the most vivid of examples that anyone can achieve anything. His accomplishment shouts, no excuses, and gives hope that the library will become more fashionable than the playground. What are you going to write about for the next 4 years, now that racial equality has finally been achieved? A buddy cracked via email. And indeed, there will be the temptation for all of us to indulge in premature self-congratulations. But bigotry, homophobia, greed, and war will not disappear on Inauguration Day. No victory comes without vigilance and struggle. Change tends to be incremental. Emancipation and Reconstruction beget the backlash of Black codes, the Klan, and Jim Crow. The Civil Rights Movement's successes produced a conservative revolution devoted largely to turning back the clock on those gains. Obama, the target of some of the most vile and absurd attacks in presidential history, will no doubt face an organized and determined resistance. But nothing will be as it was. A deep cynicism that had enveloped our land has been lifted. Obama has opened a door to a place that previously existed only in dreams. It can never be shut again. That door can only be opened wider for the woman, the Jew, and yes, the Muslim to follow. The door Obama has opened leads to America's future. One nation of many, truly indivisible.
That sounds so optimistic. Did you feel as optimistic as that sounds when wrote it?
Oh, yes. I mean, when you're witnessing something that you truly never would have envisioned, and I did not envision that happening in my lifetime, and I'm not that old, it's just amazing. That election night, as we were in the newsroom, we heard all this commotion, and we went outside, and the kids up by VCU were just going crazy. I mean, it just seemed like the 1960s, and all the hope and idealism of the 60s was alive that night. And even as tough as things are now, and as difficult the economy has made it for most of us, and despite the organized resistance that I predicted and has emerged, I still feel optimistic because I really do believe that nothing will be as it was.
Well, I was going to ask, do you still feel as optimistic? So
yeah, I knew that. I mean, I'm not surprised that every president, of course, has a honeymoon, and then it's time to get down to work, and there's going to be this is how democracy functions. There's going to be resistance. Like the quality of the resistance and the quality of the debate to be better, more elevated. But I'm not surprised. But I think what the president has been doing is forcing us to confront some difficult issues that I think we've ignored for a long time. And change is difficult. But change is necessary.
Right. We've got time for probably one more column, Michael Paul. What else can you share with us?
Wow. How about Skip Gates? That's still very much in the news. Just by way of background, I spent a year in Cambridge, Massachusetts on a fellowship in 1999-2000 at Harvard and had occasion to meet Skip Gates, who is a real character, and grew to love Cambridge, and so I have a little less distance from this than one might think. I can clearly see things unfolding as they did. So it's just kind of interesting to revisit Cambridge through this controversy. Headline, Gates' arrest was clash of class and egos. And this column was out of Norfolk, where I attended the National Organization of Black Law Enforcement Executives Conference, which was going on amid that controversy. Dateline Norfolk. As a group that calls itself the Conscience of Law Enforcement convened its annual conference here, America debated whether Henry Louis Gates Jr. was a victim of racial profiling or his own loutish behavior. Gates, chairman of the Afro-American Studies Department at Harvard University, had been arrested at his Cambridge, Massachusetts home by Police Sergeant James Crowley, who was white. President Barack Obama accused police of acting stupidly. Battle lines were drawn, much as they had been at Gates' Harvard Square residence. No one could accuse the National Organization of Black Law Enforcement Executives of closing ranks around a police officer. Noble President Joseph A. McMillan expressed concern about the arrest of a man in his own home after he provided proper identification and proven he was not breaking into the home, but was the home's owner. Incidents such as these underscore the need for continued sensitivity and training in the area of racial profiling, he said. As the details of the case emerged, Gates' arrest looked less like racial profiling than a clash of class and egos, the professors and the arresting officers. To me, it just indicates there's still more work to do with police and the relationship with the community. Marty Tapscott, Richmond's police chief from 1989 to 1995, said as he stood in the lobby of Norfolk Waterside Marriott. I think both of them lost their cool a little bit, but I think it's up to the police, especially with their training, to be the calming factor, Tapscott said. Noble's conference drew 1,200 people from as far away as London Scotland Yard. It included a workshop on race and relationships, conducted by Joyce Shabazz and Fabian Brooks of the National Coalition Building Institute, a nonprofit leadership training organization. You've got two men who are accustomed to being respected in their roles, summed up Shabazz, who lived in Cambridge for 2 decades. Still, I would have wanted a police officer in my community to be able to reach into his backpack for his professionalism. To step out of the escalation, she said. Anyone inclined to reduce this to race might note the black police officer in the Gates arrest photo. Whenever situations happen like this anywhere in the country, they impact anyone in uniform, said Brooks, whose career in law enforcement spanned 26 years. The racial profiling instructor and the scholar on race failed to see beyond the filters that can blind us in moments of stress. The rest of us aren't seeing too clearly in the aftermath. Gates' case hardly fits the profile of racial profiling. He's pals with the president and resides in the shelter of celebrity in the Ivy League. By most accounts, he exhibited a belligerence few law-abiding black men would dare emulate during a police encounter. Race, in this case, obscures the big picture. The jailing of people for exercising their right of free speech is an affront to America's ideals. Gates' politicized rant, however unpleasant to Crowley's ears, is especially protected. There was no plausible justification for him to be handcuffed, arrested, and taken from his home for simply speaking his mind. That abuse of police power should offend the conscience of a nation. In America, this should not be a source of division. In that regard, we've reacted stupidly.
What kind of response did you get when you wrote that?
Mostly people disagreeing.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Because they
just feel like he had it coming and the police officer was within his rights to arrest him.
It's interesting to me that in writing the column, you really have reframed the story from one of race to one of how people should be conducting themselves and who it's incumbent upon to remain cool in a tense situation. How did you get to the point where you could do that? Did you have to put a little emotion aside?
Well, you have to. Part of being a columnist is to let it marinate. You can't always go with your first instinct because, to be honest, the first news reports are often wrong, and there were a lot of inaccuracies with these reports. The woman who called in the call was totally vilified for things that were not true. She did not identify two black men with backpacks. I don't know where the backpacks came from if you listen to the 9/11 call. She did not mention race at all on her own, and after coaxing from the dispatcher, said, well, one of them might be Hispanic. So the initial situation was not racialized, but several things after that did racialize it, and which tells us how pervasive race is in America. But I do think race was part of the trigger, but I think the larger trigger was class.
Interesting. You have much still to say, and we will enjoy continuing to hear your words or read your words in the Richmond Times-Dispatch. Thank you for being with us today, Michael Paul.
Well, Patty, thank you for having me. I've enjoyed it.
We've had Michael Paul Williams, columnist for the Richmond Times-Dispatch. I'm Patty Campbell for the Virginia Voice.
You've been listening to the Writer's Voice. Listen online or download to your computer or MP3 player at www.virginiavoice.org. Virginia Voice. Connect by listening.